The grip on his arm was like a tightening vise. Fibbins' look of pained surprise made the mustachioed Chim grin. "They put some extra strength genes into my mix," he sneered. "That part of their meddling worked, but not some of the others. They call me Iron Grip, and I got no blue card, or even a yellow. Now let's go. We'll ask Bright Talon Squadron Lieutenant to explain what the Goobru's plans are for Chim Bright Boys." In spite of the painful pressure on his arm, Fibbin affected nonchalance. "Sure, why not? Are you willing to put a wager on it, though?" His upper lip curled back in disdain. "If I remember my sophomore xenology right, the Goobru are pretty sharply clocked into a diurnal cycle. I'll bet behind those dark goggles of his you'll find that bloody bird is fast asleep. Think you'll like being awakened just to discuss the niceties of uplift with the likes of you?" For all his bravado, Iron Grip was obviously sensitive about his level of education. Fibbins' put-on assurance momentarily set him back, and he blinked at the suggestion that anyone could possibly sleep through all the cacophony around them. Finally, he growled angrily, "We'll just see about that. Come on." The other zip suits crowded close. Fibbin knew he wouldn't stand a chance taking on all six of them. And there would be no calling on the law for help, either. Authority wore feathers these days. His escorts prodded him through the maze of low tables. Lounging customers chuffed in irritation as Iron Grip nudged them aside. But their eyes, glazed in barely restrained passion, were all on Sylvie's dance as the tempo of the music built. A glance over his shoulder at the performer's contortions made Fibbin's face feel hot. He backed away without looking and stumbled into a soft mass of fur and muscle. "Ow!" a seated customer howled, spilling his drink. "Sorry," Fibbin muttered, stepping away quickly. His sandals crunched upon another brown hand, producing yet another shout. The complaint turned into an outraged scream as Fibbin ground the knuckle down, then twisted away to apologize once again. "Sit down!" a voice shouted from the back of the club. Another squeaked, "Yeah, beat it! You're in the way!" Iron Grip glared suspiciously at Fibbin and tugged on his arm. Fibbin resisted briefly, then released, coming forward suddenly and shoving his captor back into one of the wicker tables. Drinks and sniff stands toppled, sending the seated Chim scrambling to their feet, huffing indignantly. "Hey! Watch it, you bastard Proby!" Their eyes, already aflame from both intoxicants and Sylvie's dance, appeared to contain little reason anymore. Iron Grip's shaven face was pale with anger. His grasp tightened, and he began to motion to his comrades, but Fibbin only smiled conspiratorially and nudged him with his elbow. In feigned drunken confidence, he spoke loudly. "See what you did? I told you not to bump these guys on purpose, just to see if they're too stoned to talk." From the nearby Chims there came a hiss of intaken breath, audible even over the music. "Who says I can't talk?" one of the drinkers slurred, barely able to form the words. The tipsy Baraccio advanced a step, trying to focus on the source of this insult. "Was it you?" Fibbin's captor eyed him threateningly and yanked him closer, tightening the vice-like grip. Still, Fibbin managed to maintain his stage grin and winked. "Maybe they can talk, sorta. But you're right about them being a bunch of knuckle-walkers." "What?" The nearest Chim roared and grabbed at Iron Grip. The sneering mutant adroitly stepped aside and chopped with the edge of his free hand. The drunk howled, doubled up, and collided with Fibbin. But then the inebriate's friends dove in, shrieking. The hold on Fibbin's arm tore loose, as they were all swamped under a tide of angry brown fur. Fibbin ducked as a snarling ape in a leather work harness swung on him. The fist sailed past and connected with the jaw of one of the zip-suited toughs. Fibbin kicked another Proby in the knee as the chim grabbed for him, eliciting a satisfactory howl, but then all was a chaos of flying wickerwork and dark bodies. Cheap straw tables blew apart as they crashed down upon heads, the air filled with flying beer and hair. The band increased its tempo, but it was barely to be heard over shrieks of outrage or combative glee. There was a wild moment as Fibbin felt himself lifted bodily by strong simian arms. They weren't gentle.
Wow!
He sailed over the riot and landed in a crash amidst a group of previously uninvolved revelers. The customers stared at him in momentarily stunned puzzlement. Before they could react, Fibbin picked himself up from the rubble, groaning. He rolled out into the aisle, stumbling as a sharp pain seemed to lance through his still tender left ankle. The fight was spreading, and two of the bright zip suits were headed his way, canines gleaming. To make matters worse, the customers, whose party he had so rudely interrupted, were on their feet now, chuffing in anger. Hands reached for him.
"Some other time, perhaps," Fibbin said politely.
He hopped out of the debris, away from his pursuers, hurriedly threading between the low tables. When there was no other way forward, he didn't hesitate, but stepped up onto a pair of broad, hunched shoulders and launched off, leaving his erstwhile springboard grunting in yet another pile of splintered wicker. Fibbin somersaulted over a last row of customers and tumbled to one knee in a broad open area, the dance floor. Only a few meters away towered the Thunder Mound, where the alluring Sylvie was bearing down for her final grind, apparently oblivious to the growing commotion below. Fibbin moved quickly across the floor, intending to dash past the bar and out one of the exits beyond. But the moment he stepped out into the open area, a sudden blaze of light lanced down from above, dazzling him. From all sides, there erupted a tremendous cheer. Something had obviously pleased the crowd, but what? Peering up against the glare, Fibbin couldn't see that the Ecdysiast had done anything new and spectacular, at least no more so than before. Then he realized that Sylvie was looking straight at him. Behind the bird-like mask, he could see her eyes watching him in amusement. He whirled. So were most of those not yet enveloped by the spreading brawl. The audience was cheering him. Even the Gubru in the balcony appeared to be tilting its goggle-shielded head his way. There wasn't time to sort out the meaning of this. Fibbin saw that several more of his tormentors had broken free of the melee. They were distinctive in their bright clothes as they gestured to each other, moving to cut him off from the exits. Fibbin quashed a sense of panic. They had him cornered. "There has to be another way out," he thought furiously. And then he realized where it would be. The performer's door, above and behind the padded dance mound, the beaded portal through which Sylvie had made her entrance. A quick scramble, and he'd be up and past her, and gone. He ran across the dance floor and leaped onto the mound, landing upon one of the carpeted ledges. The crowd roared again. Fibbin froze in his crouch. The glaring spotlights had followed him. He blinked up at Sylvie. The dancer licked her lips and rocked her pelvis at him. Fibbin felt simultaneously repelled and powerfully drawn. He wanted to clamber up and grab her. He wanted to find some dark niche in a tree branch somewhere and hide. Down below, the fight was still going strong, but it stopped spreading. With only paper bottles and wicker furniture to use, the combatants seemed to have settled down to an amiable tumult of mutual mayhem, the original cause quite forgotten. But on the edges of the dance floor stood four chims in bright zip suits, watching him as they fingered objects in their pockets. There still looked to be only one way. Fibbin clambered up onto another carpeted, rocky cleft. Again the crowd cheered in intensifying excitement. The noise, smells, confusion. Fibbin blinked at the sea of fervent faces, all staring up at him in expectation. What was happening? A flash of motion caught Fibbin's attention. From the balcony over the bar, someone was waving at him. It was a small chim, dressed in a dark, hooded cloak, standing out in this frenzied crowd, more than anything else, by a facial expression that was calm, icy, sharp. Fibbin suddenly recognized the little pimp, the one who had accosted him briefly by the door to the Ape's Grape. The chim's voice didn't carry over the cacophony, but somehow Fibbin picked out the mouthed words, "Hey, dummy, look up." The boyish face grimaced. The panderer pointed overhead. Fibbin glanced upward, just in time to see a sparkling mesh start to fall from the rafters overhead. He leaped aside purely on instinct, fetching hard against another rock, as the fringe of the falling net grazed his left foot. Electric agony stroked his leg.
"Baboon shit! What in good all's name?"
He cursed soundly. It took a moment for him to realize that part of the roaring in his ears was more applause. This turned into shouted cheers as he rolled over holding his leg, and thereby happened to escape yet another snare. A dozen loops of sticky mesh flopped out of a simulated rock to tauten over the area he had just occupied. Fibbin kept as still as possible while he rubbed his foot and glared about angrily, suspiciously. Twice he had almost been noosed like some dumb animal. To the crowd it might all be great fun, but he personally had no desire to be trussed up on some bizarre lunatic obstacle course. Below on the dance floor, he saw bright zip suits left, right, and center. The guru on the balcony seemed interested, but showed no sign of intervening. Fibbin sighed. His predicament was still the same. The only direction he could go was up. Looking carefully, he scrambled over another padded ridge. The snares appeared to be intended to be humiliating and incapacitating, and painful, but not deadly. Except in his case, of course. If he were caught, his unwanted enemies would be on him in a trice. He stepped up onto the next boulder cautiously. Fibbin felt a tickling falseness under his right foot and pulled back just as a trap door popped open. The crowd gasped as he teetered on the edge of the revealed pit. Fibbin's arms windmilled as he fought for balance. From an uncertain crouch, he leaped, and barely caught a grip on the next higher terrace. His feet hung over nothingness. Fibbin's breath came in heavy gasps. Desperately he wished humans hadn't edited some of his ancestors' unnecessary, instinctive climbing skills, just to make room for trivialities such as speech and reason. He grunted and slowly scrambled up out of the pit. The audience clamored for more. As he panted on the edge of the next level, trying to see in all directions at once, Fibbin slowly became aware that a public address system was muttering over the noise of the crowd, repeating over and over again in clipped mechanical tones. "More enlightened approach to uplift, appropriate to the background of the client race, offering opportunity to all, unbiased by warped human standards." Up in its box, the invader chirped into a small microphone. Its machine-translated words boomed out over the music and the excited jabber of the crowd. Fibbin doubted 1 in 10 of the chims below were even aware of the E.T.'s monologue in the state they were in. But that probably didn't matter. They were being conditioned. No wonder he had never heard of Sylvie's dance mound striptease before, nor this crazy obstacle course. It was an innovation of the invaders. But what was its purpose? They couldn't have managed all this without help, Fibbin thought angrily. Sure enough, the two well-dressed chims sitting near the invader whispered to each other and scribbled on clipboards. They were obviously recording the crowd's reactions for their new master. Fibbin scanned the balcony and noted that the little pimp in the cowled robe stood not far outside the Gubru's ring of robot guards. He spared a whole second to memorize the Chim's boyish features. Traitor! Sylvie was only a few terraces above him now. The dancer twitched her pink bottom at him, grinning as sweat beaded on his face. Human males had their own instant visual triggers, rounded female breasts and pelvises and smooth femme skin. None of them could compare with the electric shiver a little color in the right place could send through a male Chim. Fibbin shook his head vigorously.
Out, not in, you want out.
Concentrating on keeping his balance, favoring his tender left ankle, he scrambled edgewise until he was around the pit, then crawled forward on his hands and knees. Sylvie leaned over him two levels up. Her scent carried even over the pungent aromas of the hall, making Fibbin's nostrils flare. He shook his head suddenly. There was another sharp odor, a cloying stink that seemed to be quite local. With the little finger of his left hand, he probed the terrace he had been about to climb upon. 4 inches in, he encountered a burning stickiness. He cried out and pulled back hard, leaving behind a small patch of skin. Alas for instinct! His seared finger automatically popped into his mouth. Fibbin almost gagged on the nastiness. This was a fine fix. If he tried to move up or forward, the sticky stuff would get him. If he retreated, he would more than likely wind up in the pit. This maze of traps did explain one thing that he had puzzled about earlier. No wonder the Chens below hadn't gone nuts and simply charged the hill the moment Sylvie showed pink. They knew only the cocky or foolhardy would dare attempt the climb. The others were content to observe and fantasize. Sylvie's dance was only the first half of the show. And if some lucky bastard made it? Well, then, everybody would have the added treat of watching that, too. The idea repelled Fibbin. Private sharings were natural, of course, but this public lewdness was disgusting. At the same time, he noted that he had already made it most of the way. He felt an old quickening in his blood. Sylvie swayed down a little toward him, and he imagined he could already touch her. The musicians increased their tempo, and strobes began flickering again, approaching like lightning. Artificial thunder echoed. Fibbin felt a few stinging droplets, like the beginnings of a rainstorm. Sylvie danced under the spots, inciting the crowd. He licked his lips and felt himself drawn. Then, in the flicker of a single lightning flash, Fibbin saw something equally enticing, more than attractive enough to pull him out of Sylvie's hypnotic sway. It was a small green-lit sign, prim and legalistic, that shone beyond Sylvie's shoulder. "Exit," it read. Suddenly the pain and exhaustion and tension caused something to release inside Fibbin. He felt somehow lifted above the noise and tumult, and recalled with instant clarity something that Athaklina said to him shortly before he left the encampment in the mountains to begin his trek to town. The silvery threads of her Timbrimi corona had waved gently as if in a breeze of pure thought.
"There is a telling which my father once gave me, Fibbin. It's a haiku poem, in an earthling dialect called Japanese. I want you to take it with you."
"Japanese?" he had protested. "It's spoken on Earth and on Calafia, but there aren't 100 Chims or men on Garth who know it."
But Athaklina only shook her head.
"Neither do I. But I shall pass the telling on to you, the way it was given to me."
What came when she opened her mouth then was less sound than a crystallization, a brief substrate of meaning which left an imprint even as it faded. "Certain moments qualify in winter's darkest storm, when stars call and you fly." Fibbin blinked, And the sudden relived moment passed. The letters still glowed. Exit. Shining like a green haven. It all swept back, the noise, the odors, the sharp stinging of the tiny rain-like droplets. But Fibbon now felt as if his chest had expanded twofold. Lightness spread down his arms and into his legs. They seemed to weigh next to nothing. With a deep flexing of his knees, he gathered himself, and then launched off from his precarious perch to land on the edge of the next terrace, toes grasping inches from the burning, camouflaged glue. The crowd roared, and Sylvie stepped back, clapping her hands. Fibbon laughed. He slapped his chest rapidly, as he had seen the gorillas do, beating counter-time to the rolling thunder. The audience loved it. Grinning, he stepped along the edge of the sticky patch, tracing its outline more by instinct than the faint difference in coloration. Arms spread wide for balance, he made it look harder than it actually felt. The ledge ended where a tall tree, simulated out of fiberglass and green plastic tassels, towered out of the slope of the mound. Of course the thing was booby-trapped. Fibbon wasted no time inspecting it. He leapt up to tap the nearest branch lightly, and teetered precariously as he landed, drawing gasps from those below. The branch reacted a delayed instant after he touched it. Just time enough for him to have gotten a solid grip on it, had he tried. The entire tree seemed to writhe. Twigs turned into curling ropes, which would have snared an arm if he were still holding on. With a yip of exhilaration, Fibbon leaped again, this time grabbing a dangling rope as the branch swayed down again. He rode it up like a pole vaulter, sailing over the last two terraces and the surprised dancer, and flew on into the jungle-like mass of girders and wiring overhead. Fibbon let go at the last moment and managed to land in a crouch upon a catwalk. For a moment, he had to fight for balance on the tricky footing. A maze of spotlights and unsprung traps lay all around him. Laughing, he hopped about, tripping releases, sending wires, nets, and tangle ropes spilling over onto the mound. There were tubs of some hot, oatmeal-like substance which he kicked over. Splatters on the orchestra sent the musicians diving for cover. Now Fibbon could easily see the outlines of the obstacle course. Clearly there was no real solution to the puzzle, except the one he had used, bypassing the last few terraces altogether. In other words, one had to cheat. The mound was not a fair test, then. A Chen couldn't hope to win by being more clever, only by letting others take the risks first, suffering pain and humiliation in the traps and deadfalls. The lesson the Gubru were teaching here was insidiously simple. "Those bastards," he muttered. The exalted feeling was beginning to fade, and with it some of Fibbon's temporary sense of borrowed invulnerability. Obviously Athaclena had given him a parting gift, a post-hypnotic charm of sorts, to help him if he found himself in a jam. Whatever it was, he knew it wouldn't do to push his luck. "It's time to get out of here," he thought. The music had died when the musicians fled the sticky oatmeal stuff, but now the public address system was squawking again, issuing clipped exhortations that were beginning to sound a bit frantic. "Unacceptable behavior for proper clients. Cease expressions of approval for one who has broken rules. One who must be chastised." The Gubru's pompous urgings fell flat, for the crowd seemed to have gone completely ape. When Fibbon hopped over to the mammoth speakers and yanked out wires, the alien's tirade cut off, and there rose a roar of hilarity and approval from the audience below. Fibbon leaned into one of the spotlights, swiveling it so that it swept across the hall. When the beam passed over them, Chims picked up their wicker tables and tore them apart over their heads. Then the spot struck the E.T. in the balcony box, still shaking its microphone in apparent outrage. The bird-like creature wailed and cringed under the sharp glare. The two chimps, sharing the VIP box, dove for cover as the battle robots rotated and fired at once. Fibbin leaped from the rafters just before the spotlight exploded in a shower of metal and glass. He landed in a roll and came to his feet at the peak of the dance mound, king of the mountain. He concealed his limp as he waved to the crowd. The hall shook with their cheers. They abruptly quieted as he turned and took a step toward Sylvie. This was the payoff. Natural male chimpanzees in the wild weren't shy about mating in front of others, and even uplifted neo-chimps shared when the time and place was right. They had few of the jealousy or privacy taboos which made male humans so strange. The evening's climax had come much sooner than the guru planned, and in a fashion it probably did not like, but the basic lesson could still be the same. Those below were looking for a vicarious sharing with all the lessons psychologically tailored. Sylvie's bird mask was part of the conditioning. Her bared teeth shone as she wriggled her bottom at him. The many-slitted skirt whirled in a rippling flash of provocative color. Even the zip-suiters were staring now, licking their lips in anticipation, their quarrel with him forgotten. At that moment, he was their hero. He was each of them. Fibbin quashed a wave of shame. "We're not so bad, not when you figure we're only 300 years old. The Gubru want us to feel we're barely more than animals, so we'll be harmless. But I hear even humans used to sometimes revert like this back in the olden days." Sylvie chuffed at him as he approached. Fibbin felt a powerful tightening in his loins as she crouched to await him. He reached for her. He gripped her shoulder. Then Fibbin swung her about to face him. He exerted strength to make her stand up straight. The cheering crowd fell into confused muttering. Sylvie blinked up at him in hormone-drenched surprise. It was apparent to Fibbin that she must have taken some sort of drug to get into this condition.
"Frontwards?" she asked, struggling with the words. "But the big beaks said he wanted it to look natural."
Fibbin took her face in his hands. The mask had a complex set of buckles, so he bent around the jutting beak to kiss her once, gently, without removing it.
"Go home to your mates," he told her. "Don't let our enemies shame you."
Sylvie rocked back as if he had struck her a blow. Fibbin faced the crowd and raised his arms.
"Upspring of the wolflings of Terra," he shouted. "All of you, go home to your mates. Together with our patrons, we'll guide our own uplift. We don't need E.T. outsiders to tell us how to do it."
From the crowd there came a low rumbling of consternation. Fibbin saw that the alien in the balcony was chirping into a small box, probably calling for assistance, he realized.
"Go home," he repeated, "and don't let outsiders make spectacles of us again."
The muttering below intensified. Here and there Fibbin saw faces wearing sudden frowns, chims looking about the room in what he hoped was dawning embarrassment, brows wrinkled with uncomfortable thoughts. But then, out of the babble below, someone shouted up at him.
"What's the matter? Can't you get it up?"
About half of the crowd laughed uproariously. There were follow-up jeers and whistles, especially from the front rows. Fibbin really had to get going. The Gubru probably didn't dare shoot him down outright, not in front of the crowd. But the avian had doubtless sent for reinforcements. Still, Fibbin couldn't pass up a good straight line. He stepped to the edge of the plateau and glanced back at Sylvie. He dropped his pants. The jeers stopped abruptly. Then the brief silence was broken by whistles and wild applause. Cretans, Fibbin thought. But he did grin and wave before rebuttoning his fly. By now, the Gubru was flapping its arms and squawking, pushing at the well-dressed neo-chimps who shared its box. They, in turn, leaned over to shout at the bartenders. There were faint noises that sounded like sirens in the distance. Fibbin grabbed Sylvie for one more kiss. She answered this time, swaying as he released her. He paused for one last gesture up at the alien, making the crowd roar with laughter. Then he turned and ran for the exit. Inside his head, a little voice was cursing him for an extroverted idiot.
"This wasn't what the general sent you to town to do, fool."
He swept through the beaded curtain, but then stopped abruptly, face to face with a frowning neo-chimp in a cowled robe. Fibbin recognized the small chim he had briefly seen twice this evening, first outside the door to the ape's grape, and later standing just outside the Gubru's balcony box.
"You," he accused.
"Yeah, me," the panderer answered. "Sorry I can't make the same offer as before, but I guess you've had other things on your mind tonight."
Fibbin frowned.
"Get out of my way."
He moved to push the other aside.
"Max,"
the smaller chim called. A large form emerged from the shadows. It was the huge, scar-faced fellow he had met at the bar just before the zip-suited probationers showed up, the one so interested in his blue card. There was a stun gun in his meaty grasp. He smiled apologetically.
"Sorry, chum."
Fibbin tensed, but it was already too late. A rolling tingle washed over his body, and all he managed to do was stumble and fall into the smaller chim's arms. He encountered softness and an unexpected aroma.
"By Ifni," he thought in a stunned instant.
"Help me, Max," the nearby voice said. "We've got to move fast."
Strong arms lifted him, and Fibbin almost welcomed the collapse of consciousness after this last surprise, that the young-faced little pimp was actually a chimmy, a girl. Chapter 25 Galactics. The suzerain of Cost and Caution left the command conclave in a state of agitation. Dealing with its fellow suzerains was always physically exhausting. Three adversaries dancing and circling, forming temporary alliances, separating and then reforming again, shaping an ever-changing synthesis. So it would have to be as long as the situation in the outer world was indeterminate, in a state of flux. Eventually, of course, matters here on Garth would stabilize. One of the three leaders would prove to have been most correct, the best leader. Much rested upon that outcome, not least what color each of them would wear at the end, and what gender. But there was no hurry to begin the molt. Not yet. There would be many more conclaves before that day arrived, and much plumage to be shed. Caution's first debate had been with the suzerain of propriety, over using Talon soldiers to subdue the Terrigan's marines at the planetary spaceport. In fact, that initial argument had been little more than a minor squabble, and when the suzerain of Beam and Talon finally tipped the scales, intervening in favor of propriety, Caution surrendered with good grace. The subsequent ground battle had been expensive in good soldiery, but other purposes were served by the exercise. The suzerain of Cost and Caution had known that the vote would go that way. Actually, it had had no intention of winning their first argument. It knew how much better it was to begin the race in last place, with the priest and the admiral in temporary contention. As a result, both of them would tend to ignore the civil service for a while. Setting up a proper bureaucracy of occupation and administration would take a lot of effort, and the suzerain of Cost and Caution did not want to waste energy on preliminary squabbles. such as this most recent one. As the chief bureaucrat stepped away from the meeting pavilion and was joined by its aides and escorts, the other two expedition leaders could still be heard crooning at each other in the background. The conclave was over, yet they were still arguing over what had already been decided. For the time being, the military would continue the gas attacks, seeking out any humans who might have escaped the initial dosings. The order had been issued minutes ago. The high priest, the suzerain of propriety, was worried that too many human civilians had been injured or killed by the gas. A few neo-chimpanzees had also suffered. This wasn't catastrophic from a legal or religious point of view, but it would complicate matters eventually. Compensation might have to be paid, and it could weaken the Gubru case if the matter ever came before interstellar adjudication. The suzerain of Beam and Talon had argued that adjudication was very unlikely. After all, with the five galaxies in an uproar, who was going to care about a few mistakes made on a tiny backwater dirt speck such as this? "We care," the suzerain of propriety had declared, and it made its feelings clear by continuing to refuse to step off its perch onto the soil of Garth. To do so prematurely would make the invasion official, it stated. And that would have to wait. The small but fierce space battle and the defiance of the spaceport had seen to that. By resisting, effectively, however briefly, the legal leaseholders had made it necessary to put off making any formal seizures for a while. Any further mistakes could not only harm Gubru claims here, but prove terribly expensive as well. The priest had fluttered its alacroous plumage after making that point, smugly certain of victory. After all, expense was an issue that would certainly win it an ally. Propriety felt it would surely be joined by cost and caution here. How foolish to think that the moat will be decided by early bickering such as these, the suzerain of cost and caution had thought, and proceeded to side with the soldiery. Let the gassings go on, continue, and seek out all those still in hiding, it had said to the priest's dismay and the admiral's crowing delight. The space battle and landings had proved extraordinarily costly, but not as expensive as it all would likely have been without the coercion program. The gas attacks had achieved the objective of concentrating nearly the entire human population onto a few islands, where they might be simply controlled. It was easy to understand why the suzerain of Beam and Talon wanted it that way. The bureaucrat also had experience dealing with wolflings. It, too, would feel much more comfortable with all of the dangerous humans gathered where it could see them. Soon, of course, something would have to be done to curtail the high costs of this expedition. Already the roost masters had recalled elements of the fleet. Matters were critical on other fronts. It was vital to keep a tight perch grip on expenses here. That was a matter for another conclave, however. Today, the military suzerain was riding high. Tomorrow? Well, the alliances would shift and shift again, until at last a new policy emerged, and a queen. The suzerain of cost and caution turned and spoke to one of its Kwaku aides. Have me driven, taken, conveyed to my headquarters. The official hover barge lifted off and headed toward the buildings the civil service had appropriated, on headlands overlooking the nearby sea. As the vehicle hissed through the small earthling town, guarded by a swarm of battle robots, it was watched by small crowds of the dark, hairy beasts the human wolflings prized as their eldest clients. The suzerain spoke again to its aide.
When we arrive at the chancery, gather the staff together. We shall consider, contemplate, evaluate the new proposal the high priest sent over this morning concerning how to manage these creatures, these neo-chimpanzees.
Some of the ideas suggested by the propriety department were daring to an extreme. There were brilliant features that made the bureaucrat feel proud of its future mate.
What a threesome we shall make.
There were other aspects, of course, that would have to be altered if the plan was not to lead to disaster. Only one of the triumvirate had the sureness of grasp to see such a scheme to its final victorious conclusion. That had been known in advance when the roost masters chose their three. The suzerain of Cost and Caution let out a treble sigh and contemplated how it would have to manipulate the next leadership conclave. Tomorrow, the next day, in a week. That forthcoming squabble was not far off. Each debate would grow more urgent, more important, as both consensus and molt approached. The prospect was one to look upon with a mixture of trepidation, confidence, and utter pleasure. Chapter 26 Robert. The denizens of the deep caverns were unaccustomed to the bright lights and loud noises the newcomers had brought with them. Hordes of bat-like creatures fled before the interlopers, leaving behind a flat, thick flooring of many centuries' accumulated dung. Under limestone walls glistening with slow seepage, alkaline rivulets were now crossed by makeshift plank bridges. In drier corners, under the pale illumination of glow bulbs, the surface beings moved nervously, as if loath to disturb the Stygian quiet. It was a forbidding place to wake up to. Shadows were stark, acherontic, and surprising. A crag of rock might look innocuous, and then, from a slightly different perspective, leap out in familiarity as the silhouette of some monster met 100 times in nightmares. It wasn't hard to have bad dreams in a place like this. Shuffling in robe and slippers, Robert felt positive relief when at last he found the place he'd been looking for, the Rebel Operations Center. It was a fairly large chamber, lit by more than the usual sparse ration of bulbs. But furniture was negligible. Some ragged card tables and cabinets had been supplemented by benches fashioned from chopped and leveled stalagmites, plus a few partitions knocked together out of raw timber from the forest high above. The effect only made the towering vault seem all the more mighty, and the refugees' works all the more pitiful. Robert rubbed his eyes. A few chims could be seen clustered around one partition, arguing and sticking pins in a large map, speaking softly as they sifted through papers. When one of them raised his voice too loud, echoes reverberated down the surrounding passages, making the others look up in alarm. Obviously, the chims were still intimidated by their new quarters. Robert shuffled into the light. "All right," he said, his larynx still scratchy from lack of use. "What's going on here? Where is she, and what is she up to now?" They stared at him. Robert knew he must look a sight in rumpled pajamas and slippers, his hair uncombed and his arm in a cast to the shoulder. "Captain On Eagle," one of the chims said. "You really should still be in bed. Your fever..." "Oh, shove it, Micah." Robert had to think to remember the fellow's name. The last few weeks were still a fog in his mind. "My fever broke 2 days ago. I can read my own chart. So tell me what's happening. Where is everybody? Where's Athaclena?" They looked at each other. Finally, one chimmy took a cluster of colored map pins out of her mouth.
"The general, Ms. Athaclena is away. She's leading a raid."
"A raid?" Robert blinked. "On a Gubru?" He brought a hand to his eyes as the room seemed to waver.
"Oh, Ifni!"
There was a rush of activity as three chims got in each other's way, hauling over a wooden folding chair. Robert sat down heavily. He saw that these chims were all either very young or old. Athaklena must have taken most of the able-bodied with her.
"Tell me about it," he said to them.